Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Being Left Behind, the Rapture Story, right after this message. Hey, let me ask you this. What do you think's wrong with the Ten Commandments? It's pretty obvious that something is wrong with them because they have been banned from our public schools, banned from our public institutions, and banned from our national consciousness. Now, instead of these 10 simple, time-tested laws, we see the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto in their place. And they teach the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto in our public schools, public institutions. We've made them a part of our national psyche. Now, you know, this is a radical change in our political and our moral outlook over the past 50 years, don't you think? Are you aware that your daughter couldn't receive an aspirin in your public school without your consent? But she can have an abortion arranged through that same public school without even your knowledge, much less your consent. That's why I contend that the solution to this moral perversion and national insanity is to go back to what worked. Now let's go back to the Ten Commandments and the Mosaic Law. You know, our founding fathers at the Constitutional Convention in 1787 not only practiced, but they advocated the Ten Commandments, and they even put 22 principles of that law into our federal constitution. And there's still one school left in America that teaches this entire Mosaic Law, the Ten Commandments, and all 759 statute judgments and commandments, as well as the penalties and the 33 benefits for their observance. You know, every law has a penalty, and you don't have to know what that penalty is to suffer its effect. So whether you call it the Mosaic Law, the Law of God, Common Law, Natural Law, Karma, or something else, it's automatic, and it works just like AIDS, herpes, and VD, which just happens to be the natural penalty for adultery. Now, for more information, why don't you call and order my free General Law CD package first. That's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general, and it's educational, informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free of charge. And you can call and order yours right now. The number is 417-273-4967. If you're online, go to the website georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Click on to the email machine and send an email request for that free General Law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we've been talking about this thing called the pre-tribulation rapture. And in order to get a good background for this concept of the rapture theory that one out of every four people in America believes in, I've raised the issue of, well, if one in four believe it, does it make it true? Is something true because millions of people believe it? Or could it be that it's false, it's a lie, it's not the truth, even if everybody believed it? It's my contention that whether you believe something or not doesn't make it true or false. That truth exists independently of your belief or my belief. That's why science is so important. That's why science is so valuable. It's an independent test, which, if it's carried out correctly, is totally objective. It's like a DNA test in a rape case. You know, you've got a woman over here that points the finger at you and says, "You're the guy that raped me." But you know, the DNA doesn't lie. But witnesses do. And we know that 30% of all rape convictions are false. We know that now from DNA testing. You see, every rape case requires an eyewitness that points their finger right at you and says, "You're the rapist, you're the guy that raped me." And 30% of those women that point their fingers at those men are lying. Now, they may not be intentionally lying. They may actually believe that that's the guy that did it. But it isn't true. Now, if you follow that course of action, you know, and you point your finger at somebody, and you make that claim that that's the rapist over there, that can have some pretty long-term ramifications, can't it? And that's why I brought up the subject of the rapture, because people who are believing, or people who believe in and are waiting for the rapture, aren't making any other preparations or plans, are they? I mean, there's no need for you to plan for the tribulation. There's no need for you to stockpile food or medicine. There's no need for you to pay your mortgage or to prepare economically or in any way, because when this tribulation comes, you're going to be whisked off to safety. Whisked off to safety and taken care of. I was watching it. I had the VCR the other day, and there's a tape. The guy sent it to me, a couple of Canadian guys, and they're talking about the mark of the beast. And pretty interesting tape, pretty interesting story, and got to the end of it and said, "Well, thank God we'll be raptured away when all of these terrible events transpire." You know, all those people over around the Indian Ocean were not whisked off to a place of safety when the tidal wave struck. Now, if you're not prepared for the Great Tribulation, not to say that the tribulation is coming anytime soon, but, you know, assuming that it came next month or next year or 5 years from now, would you be prepared for it? Is there anybody out there who is preparing? Matthew 24 had quite a little story. I'm going to cover that in a little more detail a little later. But in Matthew chapter 24, the Messiah and his disciples had a little conversation. They came up to him and they said, "Hey, boss, tell us when these things are going to happen and what's going to happen at the end of the world." The end of the age is what that should read. The end of the age and your second coming. And he said, "Well, gather around, boys, and let me tell you the story." And he did. He told them quite a little story. And you can read this story for yourself. It's in Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21. Put the three chapters together and read all three of them, because, you know, there's a little more information in each one of those chapters that isn't covered in all three chapters. In other words, no particular writer covered all of the events. And it takes all three of those writers, you know, line upon line, precept upon precept, here a little, there a little. And it tells quite a little story. And so it raised this question in my mind. Here's the question. Why would Jesus warn you of this great tribulation if he's going to rapture you away and protect you from it? Now, out here in my greenhouse, when students come here to the law school, there's a door that leads right out of the classroom and into the greenhouse and out to the parking lot. In the summertime, I always tell my students, now, if you want to go through that door and through the greenhouse, it's a little bit shorter, and you're certainly welcome to do that. But I want you to all be aware of the fact that there are two copperheads that live out there in the greenhouse, and they've been there for several years. And they generally hole up during the daylight hours under the freezer. And then they come out at night and they eat slugs and they eat bugs there in the greenhouse. And there's a possibility, it's very remote, but there's a possibility that if you walked through that greenhouse, that one of them might reach out from underneath that freezer and bite you on the foot. And, you know, in the summertime, people are walking around with their thongs and their sandals, you know. And I said, "Well, you know, no reason for you not to take a shortcut, but I want you to be aware of the fact." Now, that's called a warning. You give a person a warning to let them know up front that there is a potential, there is a possibility that there could be danger, there could be a bad result that comes from that particular action. And that's what Matthew 24 tells us. There's some bad results coming. And he said, here's what you need to be looking for. Now, my common sense tells me that if you get a newsletter from say, Kitco, and it's talking about the balance of payments deficits and the budget deficits, and it's talking about the decline in the value of the dollar and inflation, and they tell you that it looks like another Great Depression coming like we had in the 1920s and 30s, that's a warning. Well, then, if you were using your head, wouldn't you say, well, gosh, maybe I should take some kind of action to avert or to avoid this Great Depression? Not that I'm here to tell you what to do or how to do it. I'm just pointing out that maybe you might want to consider that. That would be the intention of the author or the writer of the newsletter, would it not? At least that's the way I take it. So when I get a newsletter in here, say from Franklin Sanders or the Privateer or from Kitco or anybody, and I read it, and I presume that the guy is giving me true and accurate facts, and sometimes I double check those numbers and facts and figures, and I say, oh my God, look at this. The government tells us that the inflation rate is 3.5%, but based upon these facts, the actual inflation rate is 6%. See, I don't believe for a minute that the inflation rate in the United States in 2004 is 3.5%. I think it's 6% or greater, just based upon my numbers. Now, here's the reason I'm taking this little bit of time here to point this out. Truth exists independently of what you and I believe. So therefore, our common sense ought to tell us that we want to find out where the bodies are buried and what the truth is, no matter who it embarrasses or who it hurts. Because of the side effects that are going to come back and are going to affect me. You see, if the economy collapses, I've been taking my time, effort, and energy over the past 30 years to prepare for it. Now, let's suppose that the economy doesn't collapse and we go on just like we have for the last 30 years for the next 30 years. I'll sit back and say, well, I was expecting this over the past 60 years and it didn't happen, but it doesn't make any difference because I was prepared for it. But if it does happen, then I'm going to sit here and say, well, it's not a big problem because I'm prepared for it and I think I can handle it. And the Messiah, in the very next chapter, this is Matthew chapter 25, had a little story in there about these 10 virgins. You can read it for yourself. You probably heard this in Sunday school, but there's these 10 virgins over here, and five of them are prepared for the second coming, and five of them aren't. So when the event transpires, the five virgins who have oil in their lamps, you know, they go tripping out, and they're ready for it. They've been prepared, and they took the time, effort, and energy to go down and buy the oil, and they spent their money, and they're ready. They've got the oil. The other five don't have the oil, and they say, hey, listen, sell us some oil. Give us some of your oil. It's kind of like playing triage. And so the five that have the oil, selfish wenches that they are, say, no, we're not going to share our oil with you. We're not going to practice from each according to his ability and to each according to his need. We've got the oil, and we need it. And if we give you our oil, we won't have enough for ourselves. So we're just thinking about our own selfish selves, and we're going to keep all of our oil for ourselves. And the parable commends them for being prepared and being wise. And I guess that the five that didn't have the oil lost out. And that's kind of what I'm looking at here. If this great rapture transpires, and I'm prepared for it, I mean, I've been working hard, and I practice the law, and I do all the things that I need to do, or that I think I need to do. And the rapture comes. Is God going to say, well, Gordon, because you prepared for the great tribulation, I'm not going to rapture you off to a place of safety. I'm going to leave you right here to suffer and die. You know, somehow that doesn't make any sense to me. Seems like to me, if the parable of the virgins has any meaning at all, that the guys that are prepared are the guys that get the rewards. And the guys that haven't prepared haven't paid attention. Now you see, Matthew 24 is a waste of God's breath if he didn't mean what he said. And if he meant what he said, it doesn't make any difference if it isn't true. But if he meant what he said and it is true, then my common sense says we need to prepare for this great tribulation. And then if there is a rapture, I'm sure God will rapture me away. And if there isn't any rapture, which is what I think, I don't think there's going to be a rapture, I think I'm going to have to live right through this great tribulation in the same way that the Israelites had to live through 40 years in the wilderness. In the same way that the Egyptians and everybody else in the time of Joseph had to go through the great famine. Now, of course, in the case of the Egyptians, Joseph had prepared for the great famine. So it was a tough nut to crack, and it wasn't a fun time, but they got through it all right because they were prepared for it. But what if they hadn't been prepared? And what happened to all of the people who weren't prepared and couldn't get the food from the Egyptians? Did they starve to death? Now, last time, we were just wrapping up this Nexus article over here, so I want to give you this name and number again. In fact, you might want to call Nexus. They've got a phone number here. The Nexus telephone is 888-909-7474. Once again, that's 888-909-7474. And you can get this full-text article, and I recommend it highly. It doesn't cost anything. Just takes a little time, effort, and energy. www.nexusmagazine.com. And you're looking for the March-April issue, I believe it is. Let me look at it. That's it, March-April 2004. March-April 2004. Remember, the article is written by a fella here by the name of, let me get his name for you, so you'll know what you're looking for. Yeah, let's see, it's on page 11, so flip the page here. Guy's name is David B. Deserano, D-E-S-E-R-A-N-O, March-April 2004, www.nexusmagazine.com, 48 pages. Now, in conclusion, he says, Patrick J. Sloyan, who covered the 1991 Gulf War as a Newsday correspondent, recently wrote, when the air war began, in January of 1991, the media were fed carefully selected footage by General Norman Schwarzkopf in Saudi Arabia and General Colin Powell in Washington, D.C. Most of it was downright misleading. Now, it's happening this time, too, according to Christian Lowe of the military magazine Army Times. Embedded journalists are being hounded by military public affairs officers who follow their every move and look over their shoulders as they interview aviators, sailors, and maintainers for their stories. On January 27, 2003, CNN released a document to its entire reporting staff entitled, Reminder of Script Approval. It relayed the fact that all stories must be submitted to an anonymous row of script editors in Atlanta who can insist upon changes. It read, quote, a script is not approved for air unless it is properly marked approved by an authorized manager and duped, that is, duplicated, to bureau copy. When a script is updated, it must be reapproved, preferably by the originating approving authority. This means that although the reporter in Jordan, Baghdad, or the West Bank most assuredly understands the background and nuances of his or her story far better than the authorities in Atlanta, the anonymous CNN script editors will decide upon the spin that the story should take. In other words, CNN is censoring itself or is agreeing to be censored. Now, fairness and accuracy in reporting, that's FAIR, F-A-I-R, conducted a quantitative study from January 30th, 2003 to February 12th, 2003 concerning ABC, World News Tonight, CBS Evening News, and NBC Nightly News, and the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. It concluded that of the 393 on-camera sources who appeared in nightly news stories about Iraq, more than two-thirds, 267 to be exact, of those guests were from the United States, and 75% of those, 199 to be exact, were either current or former government or military officials, with only one expressing skepticism or opposition to the war. Now, such a predominance of official sources virtually assures that independent and grassroots perspectives will be underrepresented. And in fact, only 20 of the 393 represented the Iraqi government, and only 3 represented anti-war organizations. And at a time when 61% of U.S. respondents were telling pollsters that more time was needed for diplomacy and inspections, only 6% of U.S. sources on the four networks were skeptics regarding the need for war. Half of them were people on the street, and half of them were unnamed. Now, you've probably heard it said that the news is managed. And this master's thesis here not only will show you that the news is indeed managed, it'll show you the sources, show you where the bodies are buried, give you the names, dates, times, and places, the facts, witnesses, and evidence, which is the purpose behind this program. It's to expose the bodies. Well, at least until they shut us down. At some point in time, I suppose the government, if they don't like what we're telling you, will come in here and shut us off. Now, I want to share with you one more quick story here. I think I've proven my point, but there's one more here from the Calamity Howler. If you'll remember last time, I told you about the Agribusiness Examiner, a free newsletter. Here's a second free newsletter called the Calamity Howler. Both of these are put out by a fellow named Al Krebs. And you can sign up for these, very simple, just write an email to A.V. Krebs, that's A-V-K-R-E-B-S, A.V. Krebs, at earthlink.net. I don't know if you want to tell him George Gordon sent you or not, because I'm not sure that Al Krebs is a supporter of the Law Hour. He may or may not be. I'm not saying that he isn't, but while I'm at it, let me finish the thought that I had here, and that is that an ex-FBI agent by the name of John Lipsky accuses the Department of Energy, the Department of Potential Criminal Acts at Rocky Flats. Now, I've reported on Rocky Flats a time or two from the Agribusiness Examiner. And Rocky Flats is where we used to make atomic bombs, out there just north of Denver, Colorado. And here's a little short story to give you another little illustration of how the news is managed and how we're lied to constantly. And that's why, with all of the lies that are constantly being promulgated, it leads me to believe that it's not what you believe, it's how can you believe anything that you believe. Listen to this. The long-muzzled FBI agent who led the 1989 raid on the Rocky Flats nuclear weapons plant is accusing federal prosecutors of obstructing that investigation and misleading the public on the danger of radioactive dumping there. John Lipsky, who retired from the FBI last Friday, accuses the Justice and Energy Departments of potential criminal acts in preventing a thorough investigation, which ended in a plea bargain in 1992. He and others involved in that probe say in a memo posted on the Internet that the deception should result in extreme skepticism about current government assurances that the cleanup of dangerous contamination at Rocky Flats is protective of the public health. Lipsky appeared at a news conference today to talk about his allegations. Energy officials said the $7 billion cleanup is through, and a former federal prosecutor defended the handling of the case. And in 1989, the FBI raided the Department of Energy atom bomb plant at Rocky Flats, which had been ignoring pollution laws on the grounds of national security. The raid was the first ever by the FBI on a sister U.S. government agency, and it led to a 3-year grand jury investigation. But the Justice Department rejected what grand jurors considered to be evidence of serious environmental crimes of dumping and burning radioactive and toxic waste. A plea bargain allowed Rockwell International, which ran the plant for the Department of Energy, to pay $18.5 million in fines. No individual was charged with a crime. I pointed this out. $18.5 million to Rockwell International fines, you know, for the pollution there, is about like fining you $18.50 for manslaughter. I mean, you know, 18 million bucks to you and I is a lot of bread. $18 million to Lloyd's of London wouldn't even make the daily report. For instance, Lloyd's of London does not report a casualty loss under $100 million. Companies like Rockwell International and companies like Walmart and etc. to fine them $18 million is a waste of time, effort, and energy. But going on, the retired FBI agent Lipsky was joined in his allegations by Rocky Flats grand jury foreman Wes McKinley. He's a newly elected Colorado state legislator. Former Rocky Flats worker Jacques Brever and their attorney Karen Balcony. The four posted a memo detailing their allegations on the website. Now that website is www.ambushedgrandjury.com. It's quite a little story. I've reported on it a time or two. Rockwell International and the Department of Energy have a cover-up in operation is what it really boils down to. And the grand jury found the evidence against them, and of course they wanted to shut it up, and they did. When government wants to shut something up, they do. It's just that simple. They just shut it up. This has been going on for a long time, so I'm not going to waste a lot of time telling you. But here's my point. Whenever there's a cover-up, whenever there's something that's about government that's been found out, and it's necessary to cover it up, there's always a group of people who will work hard to do it. Take Bill Clinton, for instance. You know, he was pretty promiscuous in times past. If you'd have had that kind of conduct, you know, 30 or 40 years ago, why there would have been an impeachment that would have counted. But now in our modern day and age, nearly 75% of the people in America said what Bill Clinton does with his interns in the Oval Office is his business. And of course, the Democratic Senate at the time, they had the votes. It wasn't Democratic, I shouldn't say they had the majority, but the moral of the story was you gotta impeach this guy with 67 votes, I think it is. And there was no way that you're gonna get 67 votes. Now, what does that tell you? Doesn't that tell you that those Democrats over there approve of or at least they're not opposed to that kind of sexual misconduct in the White House. Just thought I'd point that out. That's just one more example of a cover-up. Only that cover-up was done right out in the open. I mean, you don't have the votes and we're not going to impeach him. Now, we all know the guy was guilty, don't we? Well, now let's take one more item over here. It's about time for us to take our halfway break here anyway. You've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. Now, The Law Hour, an editorial review, brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events from the scriptural perspective, and we do it 7 days a week. The sources of information that we use on this program are believed to be true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. Now, The Law Hour, an editorial review, gives credit to the authors and publications used on this program. And we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to you, our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not necessarily mean that the authors or the publications that we recommend or endorse will reciprocate. You see, most of the authors and publications cited on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, or sectarian. They may be racial or ethnic partisans who do not necessarily endorse the opinions and beliefs expressed here on the Law Hour and editorial review. So what happens is I can take a paper like the Ecologic Powerhouse, which I recommend, and I'll take an article in there and I'll expose it as being fraudulent, a lie, it's wrong, it's misplaced, or for some other reason, it's bad. Just like National Geographic, I did a story here for you on National Geographic and evolutionary philosophy. Not because I think National Geographic is a bad magazine, but because that particular article there was going under the guise of science, and in reality, it wasn't science at all. So if I take a subject and I expose somebody like 70 million evangelicals, if you're one of those evangelicals right now, you're probably not even listening. You probably already turned this program off, and so you're not being offended. But if you're still listening, the two or three of you that are, then you're very offended. But my question to you would be this. Why should you be offended at me making a report? If my report is true, then you ought to be aware of it. If my report is false, then it's not going to go anywhere. Anyway, isn't God going to rapture you off in spite of what I say or believe? I mean, God isn't going to change his rapture program because George Gordon doesn't believe in it now, is he? You don't think that God is going to be influenced one way or the other by what George Gordon believes or says now, do you? In fact, Gamaliel made that observation to the Jews. They were really upset about the Apostle Paul. Paul was running around the country, you know, telling them about Moses and Jesus and the Bible and about the New Testament doctrines and so on, and God, these Jews, they were just beside themselves. They wanted to kill him. And Gamaliel said, if this guy is a liar and a usurper, what he's telling or what he's saying, what he's teaching, isn't going to go anywhere anyway. God will kill him. And if what he's saying is the truth, there isn't anything that you're going to do to squirrel around with this guy because he's got the protection of God Almighty himself. So why don't you just sit back and relax and watch this guy blow into the wind and see what happens? That's what I'd recommend. All right. Now, with that much out of the way, the Calamity Howler, I think I told you about that one. You can get that from AVKrebs at earthlink.net. Now I want to get back here to the story that we've been working on here, the pre-tribulation rapture. Now, this is a book written by John L. Bray. Now, you remember that this rapture does not appear in the Bible. Look it up for yourself in the concordance. The word rapture doesn't appear. So I pointed out to you, you can take a doctrine like the Passover. The word Passover appears in the Bible 76 times. You can take a look at Matthew 24. Or excuse me, I'm getting ahead of myself here. I want to point out Passover. Here's Passover. Exodus 12 or Luke 22, 7 through 13. That's Passover in Exodus 12. Now, the first Passover was conducted down in Egypt by Moses and your great-great-great-great-granddaddy, 84 generations back. And there's a whole chapter there, and the word Passover is mentioned several times. It's what the story is about, the very first Passover. And you'll notice in Luke 22, verses 7 through 13, this is in the New Testament now. That's for you people that think the Old Testament's been abolished, nailed to the cross and taken out of the way. Here in the New Testament, Luke 22, Jesus instructs his disciples to go prepare for the Passover. And in fact, if you'll remember, Jesus was killed on the Passover day. He was our Passover, Paul tells us, I think, in 1 Corinthians 15. And Jesus kept the Passover every year. Year after year after year. Now, you'd think if there was any doctrine in the Bible that we ought to be practicing, wouldn't you think the Passover would be at the top of the list? But Christians don't practice the Passover. That's because it's Jewish. Now, I'm not quite sure why we don't practice the Passover because it's Jewish. What difference does it make? You eat bagels, you don't say, well, I'm not going to eat bagels because they're Jewish, do you? You don't say, well, gosh, I'm not going to eat in that restaurant, it's Chinese. I'm not going to eat in that restaurant, it's Mexican. We don't seem to have any problem eating Chinese food or eating Mexican food. Why do we have a problem practicing the Passover? Especially since the very first Passover was done with Moses, who was a Levite from the tribe of Levi. And the Passover was conducted by 12 tribes of Israel, not just the Jews. All of the tribes in Egypt practiced the Passover and did it all at the same time. And furthermore, it doesn't say anything about it being Jewish Passover. It's called God's Passover. Take a look at Leviticus chapter 23. Take a look at Exodus 12. He calls it my Passover. Now, doesn't sound like it's very Jewish to me. But even if it is, so what? At least when you look at the Passover in the Bible, you can see that it's got some scriptural authority. Now, take a look at the word rapture and see if you can find any scriptural authority for the rapture. Can you? Now, some scriptures are being cited in support of the rapture. And you'll see that in Matthew 24, verses 40 and 41, Mark 13, verse 27, and 1 Thessalonians 4, verse 17. So let me just take a second here and let's introduce this rapture concept in Matthew 24. You'll see here that there's some a woman, or two women, and they are grinding at the wheel or grinding at the mill. Two women shall be grinding at the mill, verse 41. The one shall be taken and the other one left. And in verse 40, then shall two be in the field and then one shall be taken and the other one left. And Mark and Luke both make that same report. Now flip over here to Thessalonians. Let me 1 Thessalonians 4:17. And he's talking about the second coming, when Jesus returns and he actually gets ready to touch down here on planet Earth. If I can find 1 Thessalonians 4, verse 17. Let me put the thing in perspective here, starting in verse 13. He says, but I would not have you to be ignorant, brethren, concerning them which are asleep, that you sorrow not, even as others which have no hope. For if we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so them also which sleep in Jesus will God bring with him. So those are people that are dead. People that are dead. He's going to bring them with him to some place. Where is he going to bring them to? So let's suppose that your Aunt Bessie, I got an Aunt Bessie. She was a Seventh-day Adventist. And let's suppose a good old Aunt Bessie is coming up in the first resurrection, and Jesus comes back, and Aunt Bessie jumps out of her grave in Ferndale, California. She's going up into the clouds, and she's going to meet the Lord wherever he's at, up in the air, and they're going to descend on the Mount of Olives in Jerusalem. In verse 15 he says, "For this we say unto you by the word of the Lord, that we which are alive and remain unto the coming of the Lord shall not prevent them which are asleep." Or shall not precede them which are asleep. Alright, so my Aunt Bessie, she's dead. She comes up. Let's suppose that I was still alive when this occurs. Let's suppose this occurs 5 years from now. 10 years from now, and I'm still alive. Can you see where Matthew 24 comes in? I'm down in the field picking up rocks, and I'm down there with my hired man. And all of a sudden, I disappear. And my hired man's looking around and says, "Hey, Gordon, whatever happened to you?" Now, does this mean that we've got a rapture, or does this mean that the second coming is underway? Which is precisely what 1 Thessalonians and Matthew 24 are telling you. Well, at least that's the way I see it, based upon what I'm reading. Especially when we find out that this rapture theory is something that came up in the last 200 years. I mean, it was 1812 when this thing was first published. They published it down in Chile by a Jesuit priest, if you'll remember. We'll have a little more to report to you on that. But here's the point I'm making. They're citing these scriptures off point and out of context, as we say in law. Oftentimes, a lawyer comes in with a brief, and they'll be citing Miranda versus Arizona. Okay, well, what is it that you're trying to show us? And oftentimes, they will cite a case off point. Off point means that it's not germane to the subject matter that we're discussing here. Kind of reminds me of the story. The guy came up to me and he said, "Did you know that the Bible promotes Camel cigarettes?" And I said, "No, I didn't know that." And he said, "Yeah, it's in Genesis and it says Rachel lit off the camel. Rachel lit off the camel." Now, that's kind of humorous, but it's off point. The Bible isn't talking about smoking cigarettes or promoting Liggett and Myers or R.J. Reynolds or Brown Williamson or anybody else. It's not talking about cigarettes at all. It's talking about a young woman who's riding on a camel and she jumped off of it. And in the King James translation, they said she lit off the camel. Well, that's what's going on here. It's off point. Take a look at the rest of it. Just look at it for yourself. In verse 16 he says, "For the Lord himself shall descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of the archangel, and with the trump of God, and the dead in Christ shall rise first. Then we which are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and so shall we ever be with the Lord." Now, sometimes people will take that last clause, "and so shall we ever be with the Lord," and they say, "See, that proves that we're going to heaven." Well, that's true. It does prove that. It proves that we're going up to the first heaven, and we're going to gather in the clouds. Now, I think that people have this word heaven kind of mixed up in their minds, because the word heaven translated into English comes from three sources. The first heaven is the atmosphere, the second heaven is interstellar space, and the third heaven is on the other side of space, where God's throne is located. And the Bible talks about these three locations, three geographic locations. When the Messiah returns, he tells you very plainly we're going to meet him in the clouds. There are going to be people who are dead who have qualified for the first resurrection. Why don't you add this one more chapter? It's Revelation chapter 20. And all three resurrections are mentioned in that chapter. Two of them are explained pretty plainly. And the Apostle Paul made an observation concerning the first resurrection being the better resurrection in Hebrews chapter 7. So you've got the first resurrection when the Messiah returns, the second resurrection called the Great White Throne Judgment, and the third resurrection to the Lake of Fire. You've got three resurrections here. How does that square with these concepts that these evangelists, like this Tim LaHaye that we're talking about here in this program? Now, Mr. LaHaye is probably a very sincere fellow, and I'm not running him down at all. He's probably a nice guy. But I think he believes in heaven and hell because he was being interviewed for the Lair News Hour, and the interviewer asked him, well, what if you don't believe in this rapture? And he said, well, then you're going to hell. And the interviewer was kind of shocked because I don't think he believes in the rapture either. And he thought, well, why do you think that I'm going to go to hell? I'm just a lowly, you know, television interviewer. And LaHaye said, look, I'm just reporting the facts. I'm just telling you what the Bible says. Now, I'm here to tell you the Bible doesn't say that this reporter is going to go to hell. Well, what do you mean by hell? As old Bill Clinton said, well, what do you mean is? Depends on what your definition of is, or what your definition of hell. Now, hell is a hole in the ground, and I'm pretty sure that George Gordon, when he dies, is going to hell. A hole in the ground. A grave. Now, you'll notice that here in 1 Thessalonians 4, he says, well, those that die in Christ, those that have qualified, whatever this salvation is, whatever this qualification process is, there are some people that will qualify. Mr. LaHaye evidently thinks he's one of those that have qualified. George Gordon sits here and says, I don't know if I have or not. I have high hopes. I would like to qualify for the first resurrection. But how am I going to know that I have qualified without being presumptuous? I mean, you know, I've put my application in for the job. Whether I'm going to be selected or not is another question. After all, that's a decision for God to make, not for me. Now, I want to show you something here. Over here in Matthew 7, I think it's Matthew 7, 21. Just flip over here if you got a Bible in front of you. It says, not everyone that saith unto me, Lord, Lord, shall enter into the kingdom of heaven, but he that doeth the will of my Father which is in heaven. Many will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in your name, and in your name have cast out devils, and in your name have done many wonderful works? And then will I profess unto them, I never knew you, depart from me, you that work iniquity. Now that's why I have said time and again that I think the most important thing for you to do is to obey God and keep His commandments. I think practicing the law is a whole lot more important than believing in the rapture. Furthermore, what I've observed here is that these people seem to place a tremendous amount of value or emphasis or importance upon what people believe. What if I said to you, I believe that the flood was worldwide in scope and the Grand Canyon was dug out during or right after Noah's flood? Some other guy'd come along and say, well, I think the flood was local, and I don't think the flood was worldwide at all, and I think the Grand Canyon has been slowly leached out over millions and billions of years. Okay. So we have two different beliefs. Now, I'm going to go out and obey God and keep His Ten Commandments. I'm not going to sleep with my neighbor's wife, and I'm not going to lie and steal and cheat, and I'm going to practice the Passover and days of unleavened bread and do all those things that God has instructed us in the Bible. 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments. I'm going out and work my heart out. I'm going to practice all of them. Once in a while, I might even break one. Now, When I get all through, I've practiced the law to the best of my ability. I broke some laws, and I'm guilty as hell, just like you and everybody else. We come up in the judgment, you and me. Okay? You and me. We walk in, and the boss says, "Hey, Gordon, come on over here." And he says, "Gordon, give me an accounting. You know, I gave you 10 talents, Gordon. Now tell me what you did with them." "Well, boss, I went out and I obeyed you and I kept your commandments." And he says, "Well, did you do the Passover?" "Yep, I did the Passover. There was a couple of years I didn't do it, and there was a couple of years I screwed up and I didn't do it very well, and I didn't practice all 54 items, but I did 46 of them. But for the last 25 years, I've done the Passover just about every year." "Oh, that's pretty good. Hey, did you go down to Flo's whorehouse?" "No, boss. No, after I learned about adultery and fornication, I stopped going to Flo's." "Ah, but you did go to Flo's quite a..." "Oh, yes, yes. I went down and I was playing around with Flo's girls for years and years, but I stopped doing that, boss." "Mm-hmm." So then he calls you over and he says, "Hey, Bob, let me ask you about the Passover. Did you do the Passover?" And you give him a report and you say, no, I never did do the Passover." "Well, why not?" "Well, because it was Jewish. So you never attempted to do the Passover at all." No, I practiced Easter. I worshiped Ishtar and the Babylonian mystery religion." Okay. "And did you go down to Flo's?" No, I never went to a whorehouse. I was a good guy. I never did do that." "Mm-hmm. Oh, that's good. "And did you tithe and did you follow my 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments?" No, I didn't do any of those, boss. I figured I didn't need to, that they were nailed to the cross, but I believed in the rapture. And I believed the flood was local. Or I believe the flood was worldwide." Okay. Now, on a scale of 1 to 10, we're looking for a new king to take over Cuba. I kind of doubt that Fidel Castro is going to be retained in that position when Jesus comes back. I will be amazed if Fidel Castro is retained as the president or the premier or prime minister of Cuba. I think he's going to be replaced. I think God is going to choose between you and me, and he's going to say, "Hey, Gordon, come on over here. Hey, Bob, come on over here. I want to interview you for this job." Who do you think is going to get that job, me or you? You know, why don't we think about this in a pragmatic way? Maybe I didn't believe in the rapture, and the rapture was true, accurate, and correct. And when it was all said and done, Bob, you and I were both raptured off. Do you see any logic in throwing George Gordon into eternal damnation because he didn't believe in the rapture, but he repented and stopped going to Flo's, and he repented and he started keeping the Passover? Let me ask you this, boys and girls. If the Passover was good for Moses and 3.5 million Israelites when they were down in Egypt, and if it was good for them for 40 years in the wilderness, and they practiced it every year, and if it was good for them when they went into the promised land, can you tell me when the Passover became bad, wicked, terrible, awful, and evil? Was it after Jesus died that the Passover became bad? And what happened in Exodus 12 three times when God said that we're to keep the Passover forever? Forever. Can you tell me when forever ended? When was that, 1914 or 1812? Or was that in 1092? Or can you come up with a date? I think that there's been some lying deceivers running around in our midst, don't you? Now listen to this, and I'll get you started here, and then we'll pick this up next time. This guy, Lacunza, taught that this time of the tribulation and judgment on the earth would last for at least 45 days. And that would be the length of time involved for this part of the tribulation period to take place, according to Lacunza. Remember, he said that the first appearance of Christ from heaven, when he raises the worthy Christians up to meet him, would be much before his actual descent to the earth, and that in between there would be those horrible things which will come on the earth. How much time does he assign to this expression, much before? Well, Akuntha at first said that he did not know how long this tribulation period would last, but evidently after further study, he had more to say about a definite time period. At the first, he said, this great day, which at length, or being at length concluded, the time of the duration of which we know not, the horrible tempest being overpassed, all of the impious and sinful being exterminated thence. Well then, it looks like Lecuntha and Matthew 24 and Jesus, when he was asked about this period just before his second coming. In Matthew 24, he said there's going to be earthquakes, and there's going to be famines, pestilences, and wars. Now, we just had a big earthquake over in the Indian Ocean, and it's the biggest tidal wave and probably the biggest death, or the largest death toll, maybe in history, from a tidal wave. I can't think of any that were that big or bigger. Killed 150,000, maybe more. And it's put 5 million people homeless and probably another 100,000 to 300,000 injured. Now think about that. Where was Allah when that happened? Where was Buddha? Where was God? We know, whatever God. Where was nature? Where was Yahweh? What was his role? How come he didn't prevent that? Or is that Bible prophecy in Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 21 coming to pass, and what we're seeing here are these earthquakes, which he said are the beginning of the Great Tribulation? Well, you know, maybe it's time for you to get ready for the rapture, but what if there is no rapture? That's my point. What if the rapture is a lie? It's a hoax. And you should have been preparing, you should have your oil ready in your lamp when the Messiah returns, and instead of preparing and getting your oil together, you're out here waiting to be saved from the great tidal wave. Because unless you're prepared for it and you know what's coming, you're going to be just as vulnerable as those people were with that tidal wave now, aren't you? Mull that one over and we'll take it up here next time when we come back. All right, you've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Gordon Law School and the Law Hour, please go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it's open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page at the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. All right, that's it. Signal's up. I gotta go. I'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.